there are other paths you can choose. You can choose a path of light and love and forgiveness towards yourself. And if you had told me this a year ago that that could be developed, I would not have believed it. But I sit here right now today feeling like living proof that it is possible. You do have to do the work. You are going to have to face a lot of pain. But if you put in the work and you focus and you dedicate yourself to that as your top priority, that it can be done.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hey, people. We have a very, very interesting and, for me at least, quite surprising and moving episode this week. My guest is Tim Ferriss. I suspect pretty much everybody knows who Tim is, but just in case, the man has published 5 number one bestsellers, including The 4-Hour Work Week, The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Chef, Tools of Titans, and his new one, Tribe of Mentors. He's also got a huge podcast, The Tim Ferriss Show, and a blog, and lots of other stuff. On this podcast, though, we're primarily talking about we will talk a little bit about his new book, The Tribe of Mentors, but primarily talking about his reasonably new, or let's just say newly intensified meditation habit, and I would say radically intensified, and it's brought up some really powerful, important, painful stuff for him. And so I feel like you're going to hear a pretty significant public figure at a very interesting point in his life and personal development. And he holds very little, if anything, back in this interview, which I think is a credit to him, because I think it's going to be useful to a lot of people. So big thanks to Tim in advance, and thanks to you for listening. Here we go, Tim Ferriss. Nice to finally meet you, man.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been following your work for a long time.
Likewise.
The empire you've built and continue to build. It's very, very impressive.
Thank you. This accidental career of mine, yes.
Accident? You really feel like you just kind of backed into it?
I do. I never had any plans to write at all. Certainly, that's what acted as a springboard for the podcast and everything else. The promise I made to myself when I graduated from college was that I would never write anything longer than an email ever again, after my senior thesis almost killed me.
The size of your recent books would
would
have surprised the younger you.
Yes, would be a nod to the complete abject failure of that promise to myself.
So I've been hearing stories of late, and I know you've talked about it publicly, about your sort of experiences with meditation. So mm-hmm. I want to talk about your new book for sure, and actually some of the other ones as well. But if it's okay with you, I'd love to start with your meditation peregrinations. What's going on?
Ooh, peregrinations.
I know.
Is that related to a peregrine falcon?
I think it may be, actually.
That sounds great.
Yeah, but I don't know. I saw it in the thesaurus and used it.
We don't have to talk about my new book at all, by the way. We can just talk about whatever is most interesting.
Okay, cool. So, I still want to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't mind mentioning it. But I've been beating that drum for a while.
Tribe of Mentors. Available everywhere. Books are sold.
Yes. Meditation was something I was very resistant to in some respects for a very long time. I feared that, A, it would be too new age, hippy-dippy, and unrigorous, if that makes sense. I appreciate the scientific method and all the things that it has brought us. I appreciate to the extent that humans can be objective, the ability to objectively assess data and evidence. And living in the Bay Area for 17 years, I've since moved, but I was exposed to a lot of people who were anything but any of those things, who very often at the same time were proselytizers for any number of things. Didgeridoo, fire sticks.
Dream catchers,
meditation.
Right.
And
I often say meditation has been the victim of the worst marketing campaign for anything ever.
Terrible. So now when I'm trying to explain why I meditate to someone who is equally unimpressed by the branding heritage of this word in English, I might say something like a mind. It's a bath. It's a warm bath for your mind. But at the time, for many, many years, I had attempted meditation because I'd lived in Japan for a year when I was 15 as an exchange student, which totally changed my life. And there was forced meditation, although, of course, in Japanese, they don't call it exactly that, at the beginning and end of judo practice.
Mm.
And I saw how that impacted my performance, but it served more so as a visualization practice for me. And I was always very fascinated by sports performance and competed for a long time myself. And I would read the abstracts and studies related to the transfer of, say, visualization to sports performance, free throws in basketball, skiing, you name it. When meditation was then pitched to me much later as a means of decreasing anxiety, the form it took, which was following the breath or visualizing a candle or fill in the blank, there are many different types that I attempted, did not seem to be my sport.
Can I just jump in for one second? So you
can jump in all you want.
You had anxiety?
I did. I've always...
Because you don't project as somebody who has anxiety. By the way, I mean, me too. I've had a lot of anxiety and depression my whole life, so no judgment. But you present as like a baller, somebody who's super confident.
I've done well. You can be confident and anxious.
Well, that's true. Time. Yes.
I've done a lot of work in the last few years, last 5 years in particular, including tools outside of but related to meditation. So I do not feel anxious right now, in general, not just this moment. But there was a point, and I'll just jump to the movie trailer scene that might open this. You know, this trailer's been approved for all audiences, and then we have Tim Ferriss writing with great difficulty the 4-Hour Chef, which was the first major acquisition by Amazon Publishing, which Amazon then announced in the New York Times with the acquisition of this title, 4-Hour Chef. And for those who aren't familiar, Amazon was going to effectively compete head-to-head against publishers for the recruitment of talent, i.e. authors, advances, and so on. And this created quite a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the publishing world, which had a number of effects on my experience. I was willing to take that risk. I like being the first person to try things. Sometimes that works out. And sometimes you just end up charging over the hill and catching all the arrows. So it was the latter in this case, mostly. And I don't regret making the decision based on the information I had at the time. I think it was the right decision. But the book, even as I was writing it, I knew that it was not only going to be boycotted by Barnes & Noble and almost all of the book retailers, but also the big box, Costco, Target, and so on, which I hadn't foreseen. So I'm writing a book, which is always difficult for me, of infinitely greater complexity than any of my previous books. First 4-color book. I somehow thought it'd be a good idea to learn photography by taking a third of the photographs myself. And we're talking about 1,000+ photographs in this book.
Sounds like classic Tim Ferriss.
Classic. Like, yeah, I'm choking on this cookie. Let me try to stuff 5 more in my mouth. And I was excited by the learning prospect of doing these many new things. I underestimated just how hard they were. And so in the production process, I began to resort to an old friend / faux friend of mine, which is stimulants.
Mm.
So I think we all have our molecules.
Yeah.
And my molecule was never alcohol, thank God, because I have alcoholism in my family. And that's really destroyed lives that I've seen firsthand. I can drink. It doesn't pull me to the precipice. Very fortunately, not all stimulants. So things like cocaine, unappealing. But in high school, through wrestling, actually, I was introduced by an older student to something called the ECA stack, which was ephedrine, caffeine, and aspirin.
Wow. Ephedrine.
Yeah.
And so that's the diet was often used as a diet drug?
Often used as a diet drug, but when you combine ECA, and I'm not recommending this, I'm actually advising against this, it's very much a 1+1+1=12. Mm. They have a number of overlapping biochemical effects that are very, very powerful. And it had such a profound effect on my endurance that I started using it as this other student did every day. And then it got to twice a day. And then it got to three times a day, which some bodybuilders and other athletes were doing for fat loss. Flash forward to 4-Hour Chef. I've tried very hard to wean myself off of that dependence because it had had some very pronounced negative side effects. But I'm burning the candle at both ends. The deadline is highly compressed. I usually take 3 years per book, although recently that's changed. But for my first several books, it was 3 years a book, basically. And I decided to do this one in a year and a half. So you have increased complexity, decreased timeline. And then knowing that when this boulder is pushed up the hill, if it gets pushed up the hill, that it's mostly crickets from a retail standpoint that's going to greet it. And psychologically, that really f***ed me up. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to curse
you
on this show.
You can. We may bleep it, but you can. Right. I'm not allowed to. So.
All right. I'll curse for both of
Please.
Us.
Please. I love cursing.
I'm cursing for two. I'll blame it on Long Island. But so I started taking what two friends and I affectionately referred to as Little Reds, which were over-the-counter pre-workout stimulants. And that certainly dramatically magnifies my perceived productivity, right? Not necessarily productivity, but perceived productivity. It also equally magnifies any type of anxiety.
Of course, yes.
And
the voice in your head just gets speedier.
Yeah, it gets speedier. And you're sleeping less, which doesn't help matters.
Makes everything worse.
So I really completely burned myself out, but I pushed through it. I didn't stop and finished everything there was to finish. The book came out. The book, well, we don't have to name names, but a lot of the bestseller lists that people are familiar with are surprisingly, if they were to look under the hood, even a little bit subjective. They're not pure tallies of numbers from Nielsen BookScan. And it did not do as well as I would have liked. I was very proud of the book. I'm still very proud of the book, but fell into a depression after that.
Oh,
and
I get it.
Yeah. And throughout all of this, and I've battled with bipolar depression my entire life, as have many, many males on both sides of my family. And during this period, two people at different points, friends of mine, suggested something I'd given up on many times already, which was meditation. And my response was always effectively, been there, done that, tried it, didn't work.
Referring to Japan, or were you just referring
I had tried some Vipassana meditation. I had read books by Jon Kabat-Zinn. I had read many multiple books because the allure of the supposed benefits that I saw friends experiencing was something I wanted. Nonetheless, the lock didn't seem to fit the key that I had.
And what was the problem in your mind, so to speak?
I don't think that most of the books I read, not specifically Jon Kabat-Zinn, I read that when I was about 16 after I came back from Japan, so I don't think I was even ready for the subject at the time. They were too much woo, too little prescription for me. And it was like, okay, just follow your breath. And to me, that's not specific. What does that mean? Exactly, right? It would be as if a doctor said, take some medicine. It's like, well, all right, we're missing a few details. I found most of the books very much, very high on Dharma talk, very high on scripture and Buddha references, very low on what I would consider a pragmatic, specific recipe that is not prone to misinterpretation.
What you needed was a meditation book written by you.
Yeah, well, all of the things I write, that was quite a Porky Pig I just did then. All of the books I write are books I can't find for myself.
Right, right. That's why I said that.
Yeah.
And also you get pretty damn specific.
I get super specific.
Yeah.
And then what ended up happening is not meditation per se as the broad term, but very specifically, and what I'm about to say provokes different responses in different people, but that's okay. TM, Transcendental Meditation, was recommended to me very specifically by Rick Rubin, a very, very impressive music producer. People can check out his discography.
It's crazy.
Unbelievable.
Beyond.
Yeah,
yes,
beyond,
yes.
Beyond. So he recommended to me on several times. But Rick doesn't really recommend. He's very soft, at least in this area. And he said, have you ever thought of trying transcendental meditation, you know. And he was very, very gentle with it. And the fact was, no, I hadn't. But since it's Rick Rubin, you know, all right. Rick has done a lot. The other fear, I think, that had held me back from fully embracing meditation is the people I met who gave me the most frequent sales pitches were not hard-driving type A personalities, to put it mildly, right? More the, like, dope smoking, it's 4 p.m. and I should grab breakfast because I'm hungry set. And I didn't find that example compelling.
But you're friends with Sam Harris.
I am friends with Sam Harris. So Sam, I don't want to speak for Sam, but Sam doesn't always, his go-to tool would not be TM.
No, not TM, but
yeah,
it would be
meditation.
Yeah, because he was Sam Harris, for the uninitiated, yeah, is an amazing writer, philosopher, podcaster, and mutual friend of ours who, mm-hmm, he got me on my first meditation retreat.
Yeah, yeah.
So Buddhist meditation, not TM.
Yeah, so Sam has had a very significant impact on me, but that was after I took the red pill. And I took the red pill specifically.
Okay, now these are not little reds you're referring to.
Sorry, this is the Morpheus red pill.
Okay,
this is
Matrix.
That's right, the Matrix reference. And in fact, at that time, this would have been 2009, 2010. I don't know if Sam and I had met yet.
I see. Okay.
We might have.
Is around the time when you were rejecting meditation. 2009, 2010.
That's right.
Yeah.
For the umpteenth time.
Yes.
And then Rick... I had lunch with Rick, and he recommended that. And then, for me, density of repetition tends to persuade me if something comes up a lot in a short period of time. And then I would say 3 or 4 days later, very close friend of mine, I just saw him last night, in fact, Chase Jarvis, who's one of the most successful commercial photographers, period, out there, worked with a lot of incredible brands, wonderful craftsman, really knows his work, also the CEO of a company called Creative Live, which is equally impressive, gets a lot done. He was on the Olympic development team for soccer prior to all of that, really gets a lot done. And he said, have you ever thought of doing TM? I was like, okay, this is the second time I've heard this. Give me your pitch. What's your pitch? And ultimately, he gave the pitch, and then I found out that it was, at the time, whatever it was, $1,500 to have someone give you a mantra. And I was just like, if I want to go see David Koresh, do I really have to pay $1,500 for someone to give me like a 2-syllable nonsense word?
So it sounded
off. It sounded culty. Yeah. It sounded off. And he expected me to say that, I think. And he said, look, you seem really anxious. You seem very much at the edge. And I was. And I said, yes, that's all true. And he said, what do you have to lose? You have $1,500. Spend the money. You can leave after the first day. If it really rankles you and pushes you in a direction you don't want to go. And that was ultimately the pitch that got it. It was, look, there is some potential upside, I believe. And as someone who's done this for several years, I can tell you it's helped me. And the downside's very limited. So what do you have to lose? You're clearly a f***ing mess right now. And so I did it. And I was very fortunate to get a teacher who matched me. And I think that was partially because I presented my biases and feelings right up front in the first meeting I had with the orientation TM person in San Francisco. I said, look, just so you know what you're dealing with here, so you don't get frustrated. I told them all of the baggage that I was bringing in. And they introduced me to a teacher named Laurent, who was a former competitive athlete, and he presented it in a very... once you get past the initial like offering of fruit and flowers and number of languages I don't speak, and then the mantra, once you get past that, which was a lot for me to just like swallow or bite my tongue over, it didn't last very long. It was really just a portion of the first meeting. Once you get past that, it's actually, the delivery is very secular. Very, very secular. And now, I don't want to lose the thread, but now I'm less sensitive to all of the, I'm less sensitive to what I would have perceived as the hand wavy God, mm-hmm, Dharma stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the time I was so repelled, mm-hmm, for a lot of reasons that we don't need to get into. Religion just did not sit well with me, even if it was a pseudo religion. Meditation was then delivered to me in a very pragmatic, step-by-step, all you have to do is repeat this mantra. I suggest you take 30 seconds to get settled. Here are a few tips for how to sit, and here are a number of options, depending on what's most comfortable. And the specificity really, and the specificity and simplicity really appealed to me. And I did my 4 afternoons or 4 lunch breaks of practice, and then I stuck with it. And I have since that time experimented with other types of meditation and incorporated other aspects of different, perhaps schools of meditation, if you want to phrase it that way. I did a silent 10-day Vipassana retreat at Spirit Rock not too long ago.
Just for the, again, for folks who don't know the term, that's Vipassana would be sort of old school Buddhist meditation, which is quite different in technique from transcendental meditation, mantra, and
much for me, much more difficult. Sam Harris, coming back to Sam then, who wrote a tremendous book, Waking Up, also has a hilarious, Sam's a funny guy. People don't, I shouldn't say people, but most folks who think of Sam don't have exposure to just how funny he is.
Also, what is great is to have dinner with Sam and his wife and watch his wife make fun of him. That is awesome.
Oh yeah. She's amazing. So, Sam then, once I got to know him, or I may have even known him at the time, but when it became clear that this is a subject we could talk about together, I didn't know Sam for that. This was before he had written much about it. Then had also an impact and informed some of the decisions I made about, for instance, the silent retreat. I mean, the first person I called as soon as I had received news that I would be attending this retreat, because it's very much coveted, each spot, and you have to enter a lottery, and it's very involved. Sam was the first person I called, because TM person's not going to necessarily have the toolkit or the experience to advise on such an experience, but Sam did.
Well, TM people, how would they even feel about you going on a Vipassana retreat?
They were supportive. I mean, by they, I really mean Laurent. He's the only, he's one of two people I have regular contact with, somewhat regular contact with within the world of TM, primarily when I feel like I need a brush up or I've fallen off the wagon and would like to get back on with some social accountability. Then there are one or two people, Bob Roth being the other.
Who's actually going to be a guest on this podcast soon. He's got a new book coming out. Yeah. Let me just stop you for 1 second in the thread here, because between, so you started TM, but then there were several years that passed before you decided to go on the silent Vipassana retreat. I guess,
you know, that was a few months ago.
Okay, so I really want to hear about that. But I first would like to know what, you were anxious and depressed. Mm-hmm. You started doing TM. Did it help?
It did help. I wouldn't say that it by itself was enough, I mean, to get me to where I am right now, which is not perfect, which is not flawless, but my God, in the last year, I mean, I'm a different person completely.
Really?
Very much a different person. And however, what it demonstrated for me was a proof of concept. And this was really important. Importance is an understatement. And that was, and I'm sure I haven't made up this example, there are many different ways you can phrase it, but the ability, if you're inside the washing machine, to become an observer and to step 6 inches to the other side of the glass so that you're looking, not only looking into the washing machine to observe what is moving around, but also the fact that you can observe this conceptual washing machine to begin with, right? Another way to put it would be learning that there is a teachable, learnable skill that allows you to go from being in the movie of your thoughts, mm-hmm. whatever that movie is. Could be horror, could be Mike Myers chasing you around, could be cliffhanger, could be Disney movie, whatever it might be. You have the ability to not just be a character in the movie swept up in some plot line that you have likely invented, but also to step back and sit in the audience and observe the story that you've created.
It's mindfulness.
Right. So what TM did for me was demonstrate, A, that was possible, B, that I didn't have to control my thoughts. Now, that I do think that is, in, we could delve into it, but controlling or molding your thoughts, I do think, can be a very powerful skill. But when I had attempted to meditate previously, I viewed thinking as a failure within meditation.
Right. Me too.
Right.
That is the primordial misunderstanding.
Right. And then when I begin to view it as practice stepping outside the washing machine.
Yeah.
That's it. Like the practice, the repetition of each, let's just say, bicep curl in meditation is not the absence of thought. It is each time you recognize, oh, I'm in the washing machine. Mm-hmm. Let me try to step out and watch the washing machine. That was a very profound, and I don't use this word very much, but paradigm shift for me. It's like, oh, wow. The reason I've been, quote unquote, failing all along is because I misunderstood the whole thing.
You're playing the wrong game.
I was playing the wrong game. I was like trying to play checkers on a chessboard. It's like, oh, no wonder this is so hard.
Actually, it's the other way around. Yeah. You were trying to play chess on a checkerboard.
Yes, that's
you're
that's
making
a very
it so much harder than it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's actually exactly right. I've never used that analogy before. So thank you for correcting it. Yeah.
No, you use the analogy correctly. It's just that you describe a process that I've gone through that I continue to go through pretty much every time I meditate, which is realizing I'm just being such a jerk to myself. And this thing is so much easier than we make it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just to stay with the chronology, though, so you TM didn't solve everything for you, but it really helped you notice anxiety and depression rearing its ugly head.
I still use it. I still use TM as a tool. It's just not the only tool.
So what got you to the point where you wanted to do the silent meditation retreat? Why? That's a big leap.
It is a big leap. Part of me is not sure, but I would say Sam had an influence, certainly. A number of folks I met in Silicon Valley, some close friends of mine who had this entire side of their lives dedicated to mindfulness practice I was not aware of, piqued my curiosity. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, wait a second. So the people who've been so loudmouth and brash about like bashing me over the head with Ganesh or whatever actually aren't the people who have, in my experience, the deepest practice. Yeah. And the people right around me who had the deepest practice had never talked to me about the fact that they do 3 silent retreats a year. I was like, wow, what does that mean? Huh. And there were including some people who are so, to my mind, the most frenetic, scatterbrained, ADHD, like Adderall chomping people I've ever met. And yet they did these silent retreats and they credit those silent retreats with tremendously helping them to function. And so I started to wonder, what would they be like without that? And what am I right now that I can't see? Mm-hmm. How might a silent retreat affect me? I don't know. And I was curious. I was very curious. And Jack Kornfield also, who's very, for those people who don't know, incredibly well-respected, for the sake of simplicity, Buddhist meditation teacher, who's one of perhaps, say, 5 or 6 people largely credited with bringing those practices to the West. Mm-hmm. I asked him at one point, I was like, why are you guys all Jewish? He's like, I know, it sounds like a law firm. He's like, I don't know. And we talked about it. So that's a whole separate conversation. But Jack, I had a pull to Jack. I don't know why exactly. I'd never met him. I'd read some of his work. And it ended up that he was close friends with a close friend of mine, Adam Ghazali, who is one of the foremost neuroscience researchers in the world. He has the Ghazali Lab at UCSF, which I've supported at different points and been involved with, both as a subject and as an experimenter, really being handheld through the process. But Adam's work has been on the cover of Nature, which is like winning the Triple Crown as far as science is concerned. And he is very close with Jack, which I found incredibly interesting because Adam is, by training, by necessity, one of the most skeptical, numbers-driven, objective minds I've ever met. And Jack was going to be co-leading this retreat at Spirit Rock, and he is advancing in years, supposedly one of his last, maybe his last. And I thought to myself, you know what? This has been on my mind for a long time. Let me see if, you know, I can roll snake eyes and actually get into this. And it took me a few years, actually, to finally get a spot. And I did get a spot. And it was really to see what would happen. And what happened was not what I expected.
What happened? Now you have me, man. So we should just say Spirit Rock is a meditation retreat center in
Northern California.
It's where I did my first retreat,
Yes. Yeah, Woodacre. Beautiful.
Beautiful. It is super beautiful.
Beautiful. Beautiful location. And
so what happened?
All right. So what happened was I had a tough time. I had a really tough time. And
not uncommon.
I was meditating twice a day leading up to it. So TM up to that point for me had been predominantly morning practice. I had not done it twice a day. I had and still find the 3 or 4 p.m. afternoon practice to be very challenging. Like once I'm up and going and like running full tilt on the treadmill, it's very difficult and usually unappealing for me to hit pause and do that in the late afternoon. But I did do that for several weeks of prep leading up to Spirit Rock. And I also added a layer on top of it, which to their credit was advised against. But I have a lot of experience with fasting. So I layered fasting on top. So I fasted for 2 days prior to the retreat and then the first 5 days. So I fasted for 7 days.
Whoa.
And then decided I'm going to flash. I'm chronologically jumping around a little bit, but I decided to break my fast when I was sitting in the meditation hall, which you know very intimately, I'm sure, and did about 3 hours straight of primarily sitting meditation. And the only thoughts that came to mind were calamari, fried chicken, calamari, fried chicken, calamari, fried chicken, calamari, fried chicken. And I was like, you know,
neither of which are available. Yeah,
neither of which are available. And I'm no professional meditator, but I concluded that was probably unproductive.
Yeah.
And broke the fast. But I, up to day five, I would say I tracked along with most of the group. And we say silent retreat, but it's important to note that each night, at least when I was there, there was a scheduled Dharma talk. And coming into it, I didn't know what Dharma was. I didn't know what, I'm blanking on the word for a group that meditates together.
Sangha.
There we go. Sangha. So someone said, oh, well, in my Sangha. And I was like, what? And they're like, you don't know what a Sangha is? And I'm like, no. And they're like, how many retreats have you done? I'm like, this is my first. They're like, oh my God, you're going to have an interesting time the first day.
Even though it's the first time we're meeting, I mean, I know enough about you to know that adding this fasting on top of it sounds again like classic Tim Ferriss.
I'm
going to tweak and hack my way to like, yeah, whatever it is I want.
Yeah, well, I recognize that this is probably maybe the first and last time that I will do a silent retreat. Almost certainly the first and last time that I'll have the opportunity to do it with Jack. So if it's necessary, as it is, for instance, and I do not recommend this, I'm not a doctor, don't play one on the internet, but as it is with certain psychedelic practices to reach escape velocity, I don't want to be suborbital for the experience. If this is my one shot to get on the playing field. So I wanted to use fasting as one tool to intensify the practice and to be in deep ketosis at the time, which I was, which is a fasting physiological state where your body ceases to use largely glucose and instead uses something called ketone bodies. And up to day five, I was tracking with pretty much everyone else. And I say that because, of course, I'm not talking at all with one or two exceptions, because you meet, say, every other day for 10 or 15 minutes with one of the teachers to, my words, not theirs, but ensure you're not having a complete psychotic break. And then there are these Dharma talks for, let's say, 45 minutes to an hour and a half each evening, where one of the teachers leading the retreat will talk about some aspect of the practice. And that is sometimes scripture, Buddha related. Very often is sometimes technical, which is what I was really hungry for, pun intended. But up to day five, and they would say things like, oh, it's so nice to see, like, day three is the hardest, or day two is the hardest. And everyone, you'd hear this sigh of relief, like, oh, I'm not alone. And then as it moved on, be like, you know, in our meetings with all of you, it's so nice to see all of you dropping into a peaceful state and really quieting down. And about 90% of the audience would have a sigh of relief, and 10% would be like, what the f*** are they talking about? And then day six, I had this very profound, blissful experience where I left the meditation hall. I was getting claustrophobic, not under the medical definition of claustrophobia, but I just had to get out of that room. It was too much. I was like, God, I cannot stare at this person's ass in front of me for another 2 seconds. I just have to get out of this room and like listen to that woman over there who like will not stop clearing her throat or whatever. I was just like, I need to get outside. So I went outside, which Jack had recommended actually. And went on this beautiful hike up to this vista overlooking some of the surrounding mountains. I mean, it's such a stellar environment. It really looks, for people who want to envision it, it looks like a mountaintop Japanese monastery.
Yeah.
It's exquisite. And this was about 3:30, 4 o'clock, and the sunlight's starting to dim into dusk, and you can hear the animal noises change, and I'm sitting on this bench, which I later found out, I think it's pronounced Anicca, A-N-I-C-C-A, which means impermanence, which in retrospect is kind of hilarious. But I'm sitting there, and I just dropped into this very profound, blissful state where the back pain, the hip pain, things that had been killing me, because for those people listening, keep in mind, I'd gone from meditating 20 minutes a day to... what is it, 10, 12 hours a day? It's a lot of sitting.
Some of it is walking.
Some of it's walking.
Yes, but nonetheless.
Nonetheless, a lot of sitting.
Yes.
And the physical pain melted away. I'm sitting on a hard bench. I'm not even using any cushions completely. And at the risk of making my younger self puke all over himself, I will say, you know, I felt this melting away of armor. And this opening in my chest, I very commonly, or historically, I should say, have felt a tightening in my chest, specifically right to the left of my sternum whenever I felt anger or frustration or impatience coming on. And Vipassana and the teacher's recommendations and the techniques that they discussed were very helpful for paying attention to the bodily sensations, which I hadn't really focused on before. And I felt that open up and melt in such a way that it literally felt like I had cold water poured on my chest and my back. It felt like my shirt was soaking wet. It was a very odd sensation. I may or may not have been using adjunct therapies at the time.
What? Wait, so you had stopped fasting?
I'd stopped fast. This was the day after the fast.
But what were the adjunct therapies?
I had, a few days into it, been supplementing with psilocybin, or ground mushrooms in this case.
While on a meditation retreat?
Yeah. Which I found out later, because I was reading...
Why did you do that?
Once again, I did not want to risk the possibility. I decided I would rather overshoot than stay suborbital, if it was necessary to... if the benefits were to be had on the other side of that atmospheric barrier. And we should also check on statute of limitations, because I don't want to get myself necessarily monkey behind bars. But hypothetically, if I were to use these things, what might happen? I found out later after reading some additional literature, because I support scientific research at Johns Hopkins and other places.
Where they're studying at Johns Hopkins.
That's right.
Literally studying what psilocybin does to meditators.
That's right. That's right. So I'm supporting that study, as well as a few others related to end-of-life anxiety in terminal cancer patients and a few other population studies. And now Roland in no way would have suggested that I do what I did.
Roland Griffiths professor at the scientist at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, so he had no hand in this. This was all Tim Ferriss. But I found out, I realized later when I was doing a post-game analysis of what transpired, which I'll get to in a moment, that it's very common under certain circumstances that people will relive childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So you layer on top of that fasting. So that I had fasted, and then I had this incredible opening that we could call it on day six, and then
on the bench. Yes.
And then day seven. So this is a 10-day experience. On day seven, all hell broke loose. And from that moment until the end of the meditation retreat, I felt like I was going completely insane. Any past trauma, any severe wounds psychologically or otherwise that I had received, say, in childhood were being replayed for me 24/7 in high def, to the extent that I would lay in bed. And the schedule typically involves going to bed around 9:30, 10 o'clock, and then waking up at 5 a.m. I would get in bed at 10 and I would sweat through my sheets. It was cold at night. Sweat through my sheets from 10 to 1 or 2 in the morning and then wake up at 5.
At this point, were you continuing with the psilocybin?
Let me think about that for a second. I stopped on day 8. So I stopped on day, I stopped at the beginning of day 8.
But the trauma loops were playing even after you stopped.
I'd already hit play.
Right.
And there was no stop button. So the...
And what... I don't want to get overly personal. I mean, although we do that a lot on this podcast, but to only say what you want to say, but can you give us a sense of what the movies were showing?
Sure. I'll give one example. I may regret it, but I'll give it anyway. One example was I had a babysitter at one point whose boyfriend was an alcoholic and a construction worker, big fan of the Three Stooges and professional wrestling, and his sport was to come home, get blitzed, and then choke me to near unconsciousness a few times a week. That would be one example. Mm. Right. And I hadn't thought of that in a very long time. I'd compartmentalized it very neatly and had assumed it one and done, locked away, never to interfere with my life again.
Not the way the mind works.
Not the way the mind works. And so imagine then, if you will, decades later, laying in bed, sweating through your sheets, having that replayed as if you are experiencing it again. And I was very fortunate that Jack was there and told him, well, I put my cards on the table at that point. And he is almost without a doubt the most purely compassionate human being I've ever met. It's remarkable. And it's something I noticed before I went to the retreat, something I noticed during, and certainly something I've noticed after. But if he had not been there, I think that I would have come out of that retreat much worse off than when I went in. And it turns out that my understanding is, let's just call it 10 to 15% of people who go to retreats like this have the experience that I had. And you just, beforehand, when I filled out the, I suppose you would call it, admission form, they ask you a lot of questions about past trauma and so on. And I was like, nope, fine. Yeah, no, absolutely fine. Nope, never had that experience. Da, da, da. I didn't know I was in the 10 to 15%. That's the scary part to me, is that there is 10 to 15%. But in my case, and I would imagine in other cases, you just don't know if you're in that 10 to 15%. And it ended up being a real gift, although very, very painful gift. And that, for that reason, let me take a back step. Jack was important, not just because he's compassionate. He was important because he has personally interacted with 100,000 retreatants. He also has a PhD in clinical psychology. So he's dealt with veterans who have had limbs blown off and have phantom limb syndrome. He has dealt with
gang members,
adolescents who are cutters. He's dealt with that. He has a very, very well-honed toolkit.
He's a giant.
Yeah, he's just a tremendously gifted human being. And not to say the other teachers aren't, but they don't have that breadth of experience. So if Jack had not been there, I think it would have been a train wreck. And for that reason, when people say, oh, how was your, first of all, like, oh, how was your silent retreat? Hard to answer quickly, right? I usually just say, difficult. I'm glad I did it. Thank God for Jack. That's my short answer. But when people ask me, should I do a silent retreat? My first answer is no. I say no because I don't know if you're in the 15%.
Hmm.
And if you are and you don't have a Jack there, you're on the Autobahn without an airbag, without a seatbelt on.
Well, what I will say is that the places like Spirit Rock and Insight Meditation Society, which is the sister organization.
In Massachusetts.
Yeah, right. In Massachusetts. They do actually have pretty, really good protocols in place for dealing with this stuff. That being said, Jack is uniquely skilled, but they see these people coming through all the time.
Sure. And for what it's worth, I mean, I don't know what the experiences were of the other retreatants by virtue of it being a silent retreat. Yeah. It didn't seem, I mean, I spoke to a few people who had a very tough time. And I certainly didn't share with them the details of my inner experience. I just said it was very hard. Maybe they were doing the same thing. But I don't mean to imply that Jack is a non-recurring phenomenon and that the other teachers are incapable at any of these retreat centers. But I do certainly mean to convey that I trusted Jack. I didn't know the other teachers. So I would not have, even though they might have been perfectly capable of helping and qualified, I would not have felt confident or comfortable opening up to them.
How did he help? Because you came to him with real need.
I don't want to, it was within the confidence of our session, so I don't want to give too much. And I don't think I could actually even simulate what he did, but Jack listens. He doesn't just hear you and then respond with one of six stock answers. And I did experience that a little bit elsewhere, where it's like, oh, well, have you heard of the four arrows of suffering or something like that, right? Whatever it might be. And I'm like, no. And I see that you've pulled out one of your six, you know, if patient says this, then I say that cards. He would listen, and he listened so intently that, and this is true over the last 5 years also, of doing a lot of deliberate inner work to heal some really old stuff, especially in the last year. I've realized that, like, there's hearing, there's listening, and then there's listening, mm-hmm. right? And there's watching, and there's seeing, and then there's seeing, where someone doesn't look at you, they look into you, mm-hmm. and they see things that you might be trying to say, but you can't even express. Jack has that ability on a very, very deep level. And so you feel, at least I felt, and this is, I know it's not unique to me, with him, that, and I also had a very deep connection to a woman named Spring Washam there. who
I'm laughing because Spring, who also has been on this podcast, was the person who gave me the advice on my first retreat led to one of the most profound moments of my entire life.
All right.
So Spring is amazing.
She's very gifted.
Yes, she is.
And I had a very deep connection with her, but she needed to travel and couldn't stay for the entire retreat. So I only had one meeting with her. But I knew from the very first moment I interacted with her, very briefly, for a host of reasons. Actually, I didn't know the reasons at that point. I just felt like she and I had things to talk about.
She's also done a lot of work with psychedelics.
Yes. And I feel like I have a bit of a radar for that now.
Yeah.
And so Spring's been, let me tell you another, like, crazy, just to get really woo-woo and hand-wavy. So before I had gone on my retreat, I have this newsletter that goes out every Friday called Five Bullet Friday it's just cool stuff that I found or things I'm thinking about, whatever it might be. And it's something fun for me. It's almost like a diary, because I'll never actually sit down and do a Dear Diary entry. And one of the entries is quote, I'm pondering. When I find quotes I like, I put them into this. And I had selected a quote about 3 months before the retreat by Spring, not knowing anything about her. Scheduled it. It came out the week after the retreat. And then I put the pieces together. I was like, oh my God, it's the same Spring. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. She also, and I'm sure many people do, but Jack's ability to see beyond seeing and listen beyond listening is very well developed.
And you could say trained.
It's absolutely trained. Absolutely trained. I mean, I think he has that superpower. Sounds so ridiculous. He has that faculty. He has a highly developed capacity for that. Just like you might look at someone with certain insertion points in their Achilles tendon, you're like, all right, that person can jump really high. I know already, just by looking at the anatomy of their calves, they can jump a lot higher than I can. I think Jack is predisposed to having a very high capacity, but then he developed it.
Right. So you referred to it as a gift earlier.
The
difficulty of it. In what way? Where has it left you?
Yeah, it's very clear. What I realized is that the, let's just say 27 or 47 or 64, whatever number of issues I might have that I'm consciously aware of, things that have sabotaged relationships, things that have led me to be brutal with myself, things that have stymied me or confused me in some way, or behaviors that have been inexplicable to me, right? Like self-defeating behaviors that I know are self-defeating, and yet they persist. Why? And what I realized, which in a way was very reassuring or uplifting, and in other ways very intimidating, is that they were all the same thing. They all tracked back to that unresolved childhood trauma, or a lot of the trauma.
And you, are you referring to one thing from your childhood, or just generalized trauma?
No, like the gestalt of all of that stuff that I had locked in a box and buried 100 feet underground, expecting it never to surface again. So then the question was like, well, okay, now what? You know, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
It's one thing to be aware of a problem. It's quite another to have a plan or confidence that you can resolve the problem. Jack was very, very helpful once again in making a number of recommendations. I'm not going to repeat them here because we're getting into some very serious stuff, and I think people should seek professional help if they feel like this resonates and they have some deep, you know, deep painful experiences that haven't been resolved. But he recommended a number of trauma specialists for me to look into. And I began to think more about how I might also do not detective work, but what other modalities might also be worth testing to help with this, now that I felt I had identified the target, right? And as soon as I got out of the retreat, you know, fortunately, I'm very good at making plans and scheduling things and getting things done. And so I was like, all right, well, this is the work. Like all the business stuff that I was thinking about, all the New Year's resolutions, all second place, not second place, like 97th place, and everything in between from 1 to 96 is this work. So between the silent retreat, which was in October, and now, that's all I've been focused on.
Good for you.
And I feel, threw a lot at it, you know, everything in the kitchen sink, and
including more I would assume a certain amount of therapy, but also meditation.
Yep, with very, very, very qualified supervision, and it's been the most powerful, or I would say, transformative 3 months of my life. Almost certainly.
You're gonna write about it?
No, without question. I'm hedging. Yeah, without question.
You gonna write about it?
I would like to. I would like to. I feel conflicted about it, because when you have, with great audience comes great responsibility. And what I've realized, particularly with an audience that is, let's just say, roughly 70% 20 to 40 year old hard charging type A males who don't always have the best instincts when it comes to self-preservation. If you have millions of those, statistically, let's just pretend it's a city. It's like some percentage of those people are going to kill themselves. Some percentage of those people are going to do bad things to other people. Some percentage don't follow directions. And it's not any fault in the audience. It's just a game of numbers. And what I realized is, for instance, there's a chapter in the 4-Hour Body on my second book on breath holding. That was David Blaine, the illusionist and endurance artist, taught me how to hold my breath and go from 45 seconds to almost 4 minutes. And he at one point held a number of world records related to that. Chapter full of warnings. I mean, all caps, all bold warnings throughout the entire chapter. And nonetheless, there were a number. I remember at one point, one reader left a blog post and was like, yeah, I went, I tried. And I said, never try this in water. Over and over again. And then there was a blog post at one point, or a blog comment that I saw, which said, I went to the public pool and I tried this and I passed out. And then the lifeguard pulled me out and I dislocated my shoulder. He's like, how should I train this properly? And I was just like, oh my God, this is there's so little upside here and so massive a downside that I took it out of the book. So chapter came out. And with this type of work, particularly if I were to write about this, there is, if I were to be truthful, there's no way that I could omit plant medicine. There's no way.
Plant medicine meaning like ayahuasca, psilocybin.
There are many
People talking about this in responsible ways. Spring, who's been on the show, has talked about it. Michael Pollan has a book coming out. I'm sure you know that know about plant medicine. So you could do it.
I could. I just recognize that as powerful as these tools are, the power that they have to heal is equal in their power to destabilize.
Sure. I mean, as Sam has described, that you're getting on a rocket and you don't know where the rocket's going.
Right. And as Sam has also said, you will develop, if you go deep enough, a profound empathy for people with mental illness. Because you will walk down the street and you will have experienced, in some capacity, what those people are experiencing.
Right.
And I should say, you know, not everyone comes out, and this is an unpopular thing to say, but with these compounds, particularly if people have a history of schizophrenia, which they may not even be aware of, right? If they've not had a thorough family medical history in some way explained to them by their parents or grandparents and aunts and uncles, who may also not have ever labeled it as such, you can go off the rails and not come back. Mm. So I feel a tremendous responsibility to think through the ramifications before getting into it. But there, I've been keeping notes for 5 years on all of this. I have the raw material for a book, and it's just a question of when and if I will feel that the calculus makes sense if I'm the mayor of this city.
Yeah.
The greatest good for the greatest number of people.
I get it. I understand your reticence. I have a comment and then a last question. Mm-hmm. The comment is, the word that comes to mind for me is bravery. I mean, it requires a lot of bravery for you to discuss this publicly, A, and B, to do the work. So I commend you for that, and wish you the best of luck as you continue to do the work, because it will last the rest of your life, you know, working on your own well-being, and that is the work of a lifetime. So
thank you.
I have a lot of respect for what you're working on.
Thank you.
The final question I have before I let you go is Tools of Titans. Mm-hmm. No. Tribe of Mentors.
It's confusing. They both start with T. I do the same thing.
Tools of Titans is the penultimate book. The ultimate. Well, it's not going to be your last book, but the second most recent book is Tools of Titan. Mm-hmm. This one is called Tribe of Mentors. Can you just kind of tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. I'll say a little bit about it, and then I'd love to make a closing comment that's related but not entirely related to the book.
Great. Mike is yours.
Yeah. Tribe of Mentors, very simple. We've talked about it. I've had a very, very tough last 2 years. A lot of beauty, but also some real cracks in the cosmic egg and some extreme emotional pain beyond anything I've experienced in decades. On top of that, a number of close friends passed away, including one of the mentors in Tribe of Mentors, Terry Laughlin. Very unexpected, the man who taught me how to swim when I was in my 30s, believe it or not. And I had a lot of questions come up as I turned 40 about a year ago. And turning 40 doesn't scare me. That didn't throw me off kilter. I take good care of myself. I feel very good about it. But it was a milestone that led me to revisit a lot of my priorities, my life, my friends, my goals, how my behaviors had led me or misled me in different ways up to this point. I had a lot of questions, and I decided to take those questions after I boiled it down to about 11 questions and ask for help, which is something I'm not historically good at. So I rather than just sit down and try to figure it out on paper, which is not always seldom the best approach for me, I decided to take those 11 questions and send them to about 130 people who were some of the most impressive minds and hearts I could track down. So people involved with meditation like Sharon Salzberg, people involved with, say, addiction research and medicine, as well as plant medicine like Dr. Gabor Mate, also including icons of, say, sport like Kelly Slater, most decorated surfer of all time, or Maria Sharapova, you name it, right? And you've got the authors of all different types. Sam Harris is in there. And to try to borrow from their answers, to learn from their answers. And the book is a collection of short profiles, including their answers. So there are 130. They range, you know, I would say, in length from 2 to 10 pages. Yuval Harari of Sapiens closes out the book. You would like his, I think you'd like his profile.
I want him on the show.
He is so fascinating. He's listening. Yeah. He might be on a 2-month meditation retreat.
He's a serious
meditator. And actually, I owe him a thank you. So his profile was the final nudge that got me to press go and do the silent retreat, because he talked about how his first silent retreat fundamentally changed his entire life and how none of his books would have happened had it not been for that and the subsequent meditative practice.
I could say the same thing for myself.
Yeah. So that's that. And then in terms of closing comments, I'd just like to say to people, and if anything I've said has resonated in terms of, if we zoom out, the fact that I have spent my entire life, minus the most recent 6 months, let's say it, at best tolerating myself, typically loathing myself and being extremely brutal. I didn't view myself as worthy of love, certainly not self-love. It seemed self-indulgent. And I'd focused on just becoming an instrument of competition, and that I could help other people experience joy, but that my function was to be an instrument of high pain tolerance and competition. And that was my function. That was just it. Like, frogs are frogs, horses are horses. Tim is a instrument of competition with high pain tolerance. And I just want to say to anyone who feels like they merely tolerate themselves that you cannot love other people fully if you merely tolerate yourself. And I actually read a quote from Gertrude Stein recently, of all people, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but it was, you know, we must remember that the golden rule goes in both directions. Mm. So people are familiar with the do unto others as you would do unto yourself, have them do unto you, but you also need to do unto yourself as you would do unto others. And developing your relationship with yourself as a friend. I found loving kindness meta-meditation very helpful for this. Another gift that Jack and I think her name was Kanda, a meditation teacher at Spirit Rock. And I remember sitting down and telling them that I'd found the meta, M-E-T-T-A. Jack signs all of his emails, much meta, which is loving kindness meditation, where you project goodwill and love and well wishes and lack of pain and suffering to people. And I had done this for mentors and teachers and friends and loved ones. And right before I was about to leave, this other meditation teacher, I want to say it was Kanda, I apologize to her if it's not the right name, but I'm getting close, said, just a quick question. Have you done any loving kindness projected at yourself, or at younger versions of yourself, or versions of yourself that were afraid or hurt? I said, no. Didn't even occur to me. And she was like, yeah, I think you should try that. And that was a huge, huge game changer. And I would just say, not to be too long-winded about it, that if you feel like you have been or are in a place like I've described for myself for my entire life, I would underscore that you don't have to choose that path. There are other paths you can choose. You can choose a path of light and love and forgiveness towards yourself. And if you had told me this a year ago, that that could be developed, I would not have believed it. But I sit here right now today feeling like living proof that it is possible. You do have to do the work. You are going to have to face a lot of pain. But if you put in the work and you focus and you dedicate yourself to that as your top priority, that it can be done.
I'm incredibly glad and grateful that you said that. It is not long-winded. There are fewer, more important things, sentiments, I think, that can be imparted, could be boiled down to what I view as the animating inside of my whole meditation evangelical side hustle, which is the mind is trainable. Yep. We're not stuck with all of the psychological and stuff that you don't like. And you are living proof of that. So.
Thank you. Yeah, the mind is trainable and the heart is openable.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me. I've wanted to have a conversation with you for a long time, so this is fun. Thank you.
This surpassed even my already high expectations. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.